Welcome to This Week in Debian, the podcast that brings you the latest news and interviews inside the Debian community. Brought to you by FrostbiteSystems.com, providing desktops and notebooks pre-installed with Debian. Every purchase from Frostbite Systems, a portion of the proceeds will be donated back to Debian and help support this great project. So stop on by FrostbiteSystems.com and get your Frostbox today. Hello and welcome to This Week in Debian. Thank you for joining us today. We're speaking with Ashish, a very active member in the Debian community. Ashish, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
So, we were talking quite a bit before the interview, so we have a lot of ground to cover here. So, I guess before we get into too far into anything, really, I'd love to ask everyone that I interview is, how did you even first get involved into Linux?
Sure. So I think that's a really interesting question. And actually, I want to hear this from millions of people who use Linux and GNU. So I got involved, So I was at this summer camp with a library, kind of a nerdy summer camp called CTY. And I'm watching this kid. I'm like 13 years old. I'm watching this kid type into some, white on black text thing. And I sort of look over my shoulder and say, "Hey, that looks pretty cool. What are you doing?" He says, "Oh, I'm compiling some C++ code on a Linux machine." And I don't say anything, but I'm like, whoa, this is the coolest thing ever. somehow in middle school, I came to worship C++ because it was that programming language that when I become a real programmer, that's what I'll use. And, right now I just know some basic and some batch scripting. So then I went home and fired up Internet Explorer and went to Hotbot or something and searched for Linux. And I was lucky enough to have my own computer at the time in my bedroom in the beginning of high school. So I looked up Linux and found a distribution called Peanut Linux, and things went on from there, I guess. One of the things that really helped me get my foot deeper into Linux is that we had a bunch of computers at home, and so we had to route the internet at home between them. And this is before you could get a Linksys home networking gateway box.
Right.
So I had to somehow figure out networking. And that's sort of what made Linux useful to me at home. But the other thing that made it fun, actually, to tell you the truth, is that one of the first things I did, I played with Peanut Linux, and then I got into Mandrake. And Mandrake had this really cool email program called Pine. And that was probably one of the coolest things about running Linux. Like, I was like, well, I can reboot back into Windows and play video games, or I can read my email in Pine. So the choice was clear. And then I ended up with a home server and tried to evangelize to some friends in high school, which went, some here, some there, mostly there. And I guess I was sort of a user who found it exciting, but didn't really understand the philosophy about it. But then in 10th grade, I was taking a C++ class, finally, like the coolest thing ever. And I was editing it in a text editor that came with Mandrake called Emacs. And, when it loads up, it says press Control X H or something to read the GNU manifesto. And I was like, okay. And then I read the GNU manifesto and then I was like, oh, this is really important. I get it now. And that's sort of both the technical and the cultural conversion together for me.
That's cool. So what ended up bringing you to Debian? How did you land there?
So I was using Mandrake in part because Mandrake, anyone who's either read a lot of the Free Software Foundation website or who was around in 1999, 2000, remembers that KDE was this up-and-coming new desktop environment that was GPL software, totally free software. Mm. And in order to run it, you had to compile it against a widget library called Qt.
Yeah.
It was licensed under a different open source license called the QPL, but it was incompatible with the GPL. So when you load up Red Hat, it's kind of ugly. When you load up Mandrake, because Gael Duval didn't really care about the licensing issue, apparently, Mandrake just shipped KDE pre-compiled and it was totally great. So I was using that for a while. And then I started to want fresher and fresher software, and Mandrake had this thing called Cooker, where the latest version of packages got uploaded and you could install them. And somehow when I learned about, freshly updated Linux distributions. I also learned about Debian, and then I wanted to set up a server. So sort of a couple of things led me in the Debian direction, and then I just stuck with it from 2001 on to about now.
Nice. So, yeah, like I said at the beginning of the interview, you're quite active in the community, so I guess...
I think as far as I can tell, active means I send a lot of emails.
Well, hey, that's active. And like I said, just from talking to you, from some of the things that you're working on and everything, you're definitely an active person, so don't sell yourself short there. I think we need more people like you being this active, so...
Sure.
Or if we did, maybe there'd be a lot of chaos then, who knows. But yeah, so you mentioned that you gave a speech at the latest DebConf of Debian is for shy people. Is that what you called your talk?
So the talk called Debian for Shy People.
Okay.
And I guess I submitted it thinking I guess I've been thinking a lot about how, so it sort of started for me with the story where, so I lived in Philadelphia from September 2009 to September 2010. And there I met a young woman named Elizabeth Krimbach, who is a Debian and Ubuntu contributor.
Mm.
And, I noticed something she did that reminded me of something I did, which made me think it might be a broader trend.
Mm.
So, she wanted to file a request for removal of a package, and so the Debian bug tracker documentation is somehow very clear, but simultaneously very hard to use, I think. And we later on in this talk, we can talk about how to improve that, but that's the way things are for now.
Yeah.
And so she was checking in with me like, hey, I need to get this package removed. I want to make sure I do things correctly, and sort of implicitly saying, I don't want to embarrass myself by doing things wrong and then having to submit another bug report with the things fixed. And the thing that struck me about this is that there are public, resources for getting help on using the bug tracker. There's an IRC channel probably. You can ask them to dig into the Bell mailing list or somewhere else. But she chose to reach out to somebody she knew personally to ask this actually technical question. And I realized that I do the same thing. Like when there's a question that I feel like, well, I should know the answer, but I don't know the answer, I'm not likely to email the Debian mentor or the Debian devel list. I'm more likely to try to find somebody I trust who I won't feel embarrassed talking to.
Mm.
And so, the concept of Debian for shy people is sort of like at these moments where you want to do something valuable for the project, but you're not totally sure you're going to do it right. Either somehow the project can support you, through having a friend in the project or maybe some other mechanism, and the project can move forward by getting this result. Or instead, and I think this happens a lot, people get confused as to what to do and they just don't do it then. And then the product doesn't get that contribution.
Mm.
So, I guess I submitted this talk to DebConf wondering if it would get accepted. And to my surprise and glee, it did. So then I had to make it. It was actually a bot. It wasn't, I actually kind of, I wasn't totally sure what I wanted to say. And like, really, I wanted to be a conversation. So I made it a Birds of a Feather session. And there ended up being this pretty packed room, at Columbia, at DebConf, and in New York. And I just found that like touching, that there are all these people who are interested in how to make the project less intimidating, I guess.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I asked people was, so when you have an embarrassing question, something you're not sure, that you even should be asking, although truth be told, you should be, because if you get the answer, you can do the thing. Who do you turn to? And most people, do you have anyone to turn to? Is what I asked first.
Mm.
And nearly no hands went up. And I was like, man, like, we should somehow be better friends so that we can help each other. And then some people in the back said, actually, we usually speak with other, we ask other people who also natively speak Spanish. Apparently, fear of speaking English wrong for non-native speakers is a big obstacle.
Mm.
And I guess the take home for me was that my, I feel like my sensation that there's contributions are being dropped on the floor just because we're not answering people's questions, I think that's still true.
Mm.
And I think that if there's one thing that I learned from that session is that a lot of other people are in the same position that I am sometimes that lives within that time.
Yeah. So I guess that that leads into sort of what you're working on with the Debian mentor mailing list then. Right. That's how that comes into play then?
Yeah, so I led this BOF and it was a lot of fun. And it was really nice to have it on the first day of the conference. It was actually on Debian Day, which was unusually this year. They put Debian Day at the beginning of the conference.
Yeah, it was on a Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah, and so Debian Day, they invite anyone in the Debian broader community, not just contributors right now. And so it was a couple of other people, actually. I was really pleased and like it felt really nice that some other people actually blogged about the event. And for some of the non-contributors, they said they didn't understand the technical conversation as to what kinds of things people, you know, some of the resources we were talking about or some of the packaging questions people were talking about. They didn't understand what those were about, but they got the general sense that that we wanted the product to be friendlier for new contributors, and they really liked that. And so, but because it was on the first day, it meant that I got to spend the whole next week sort of talking with people about it. And one of the big things that everyone said was like, oh, clearly, you know, I don't get it. This must be a joke. Ashish, you're talking all the time at DevConf. How can you be shy? But I mean, so this is sort of the sense in which I think it's slightly a misleading name, maybe, or misunderstood. Because it was really like Debian for moments of shyness or moments of insecurity.
Mm, mm.
You know, everybody has those.
Yeah, and, definitely.
And so I was talking with Niels, a recent Debian developer, about this. And one of the things that we really agreed about was that we had this mailing list called Debian Mentors, but we don't really do mentorship on it so much as we do package review. Mentorship is usually a one-on-one experience where somebody is sort of, you create a trusted, personal, highly small relationship.
Mm.
And on the Debian Mentors list instead, you broadcast your request for sponsorship to this massive audience and you hope that somebody replies, and whoever replies is basically random. And you never get to know anyone really well, so then you don't end up necessarily building these comfortable relationships where you can ask questions like ones you're embarrassed about.
Yeah.
And so, then I spent like a month evading Niels and IRC because, you know, I sort of identified this problem and we'd sort of agreed that we should fix it and that I should fix it. But then I wasn't really sure how, and I don't know. So, finally a month later, he corners me on the Debian Say Hi channel and he says, you know, so we should talk about this, right? I've been trying to ping you about it for a month and a half. And I was like, okay, fine. You're right. So what we agreed to chat at some later time. And then at that later time, I explained that the reason I hadn't done anything about the mentorship thing is that I wasn't really sure how to get people on board. And actually, that's something that the Debian Women Project has been doing recently, which I'm really happy about.
Mm.
They've been helping identify mentors and hooking them up with new mentees, connecting them. But the thing that was really bothering me the most, I realized, was that, you know, I am a Debian developer. I got my account mid last year, mid 09. And that's after some long, years long process, whatever. But, now that I'm a Debian developer, I can sponsor packages. I feel like people would trust me if I reviewed them, which is cool. But, I was looking in September at the archive, the Debian mentors list, as I, you know, received the emails day by day. And it just seemed like, there's so many requests for sponsorship, all these really hopeful new contributors, and I don't have time to answer all these emails. And if I only answer a couple of them, well, then somebody emails me privately and says, hey, would you review my package too? And like, I sympathize with the desire to have your work reviewed. And I know in principle that it's really important to Debian that we get new people and that we teach them, but I can't do it all by myself. And then if I only do a tiny fraction of it, it feels like it hardly matters.
Right.
So I thought that, and at the same time, it's terrifying for a new contributor to do all this work and say, here, I did this. Would somebody please let me know if it's any good? And then hear nothing back.
Mm.
And so Niels and I, you know, I sort of stepped back and said, well, I don't know if I can handle creating true mentorship yet, but what we can do is make the list more terrifying for me, personally. You can make the list less terrifying for me by setting this goal that Niels and I agreed to, that we would respond to every email on that list within 4 days.
Mm.
And 4 days seems like a reasonably short amount of time, or like reasonably short where we're not terrifying anybody for the silence. But more importantly, if we tell people that we have that goal, then they'll understand if we take 4 days. And maybe if we take a little bit more, they'll be like, okay, well, I'm probably going to get a response.
Right.
But that's... And... yeah, so that was, I think, maybe the end of September, maybe early October. And I... I mean, this is why I say, when you say I'm very active, I say, well, I just send a lot of email. Because the things that happened on the list were really interesting. I mean, for me, personally, the biggest thing that happened is the list is fun to read now.
Mm.
There's... When people submit their request for sponsorship emails, they get replies and people review their packages, and often they get uploaded. Michael, MT at Debian, figured out, he noticed that we weren't successfully meeting the 4 days goal. And he was concerned, as I understand it, that there wasn't enough human power available on the list to review these packages.
Mm.
How do you encourage other Debian developers to do this review? And this was actually a big discussion on the 4 days email thread where Niels and I said, we'll do this.
Yeah.
And I had a sort of idea in the back of my mind, which is like, if the list is sort of negative fun for me to read, but I could contribute. If all we do is make the list a happier place, we don't need to create new people. We've just increased the joy from participating on the list, so more people will actually come out of the woodwork and help out.
Now, when you said you'd respond in 4 days, did you only mean you and Niels or any of the other mentors?
Well, so the goal is for the mentee, for the new contributor, to have the promise that they get a response within 4 days. And to me, it doesn't really matter who responds.
Right, okay.
It's about eliminating the terror of the silence.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm sure, you know, once you, you know, contact the mailing list, you're like, oh, I should hear back from them tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes and goes, and you're like, oh, well, yeah, the next day. And then, you know, 5 days later, they're probably like, I wonder if they got my email, you know?
You're like, it's in the archives. I mean, so this is a familiar story for me, because I was, you know, uploading packages to mentors.debian.net and submitting requests for sponsorship emails only a few years ago.
Yeah.
So but you asked if it's me and Niels or me, Niels, and everybody. And the goal was to rope in more people, but not to assign people work that they didn't want to necessarily do.
Right, right.
So me and Niels and I decided that we would hold the line to the extent we could. And then Michael, you know, is worried that there's not enough person power available here. So a month later, this really amazing thing happens that made me really happy on the list. And he says, like, help, help, this isn't working. We're not going to be able to make 4 days. I guess we have no choice but to ask new Debian mentees, people who aren't Debian developers, to do a package review, because otherwise we can't make this deadline. And then now the list is like flowing with activity and lots of new contributors doing package review. And of course, what the new contributors are learning, I imagine, is that teaching is a really good way to learn.
Mm.
That it, so they're, you know, we're getting, we're going, these, this, this, generation of people who come out of this process will know more about Debian packaging and the rules of the whole, because they've had to dissect other people's work.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And that all was, possible. Because we set this goal that then we failed to meet. And now we're meeting it, I think. basically.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like you said, and obviously people who are doing packaging would be likely interested in reviewing the packages. And like you said, they're going to pick up stuff reviewing packages that they otherwise might not have by packaging.
Yeah, and there are some people who aren't interested in reviewing packages who are Debian mentees, but it's not essential that everybody participate. It's only essential that enough people participate.
Right.
To meet the 4 days goal.
Yeah, that's really cool. That must, like you said, it's been a lot more effective that way. So that's pretty good. Did Michael pick up any of the slack by reviewing more packages?
Yeah, I mean, he's been a huge help. I mean, this is why I say I just sent email. Like, the list is flowing with activity, and I've hardly done one package review for the list in months, but it's like, there's so many more people, Michael, Niels, the other mentees, Monica, like, it's hopping with activity.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. What are some of the other stuff that you're doing currently in Debian right now?
So I guess the other thing, as I began that 4 days thing, people started talking about the old mentors.debian.net software.
Mm.
And that's where new contributors upload their packages to that. And then it lets them host the package files, the source packages somewhere, while other people review them. And then when they actually get uploaded, they get removed from that staging ground because they're actually in the archive now. The software for that is pretty old, and I wanted to make some modifications to it, but I found it kind of tough. It turns out that 2 years ago, Johnny Lamb made a new project called Deb Expo, which is a rewrite of the mentors.debian.net software in Pylon, which is a pretty modern web framework. And so, I mean, I think the theme, if there is a theme for my work in Debian in the past few months, it's been trying to fight frustration and isolation.
Mm.
And, you know, this is not technical work, so it's a good thing I'm already a Debian developer, because I probably wouldn't be able to get DD status for doing this. and, you know, maybe with the new resolution that the GR that we've passed, maybe somebody else who just does this stuff actually would get status for that. But seriously, so then we identify this new locus of terror, which is the person who maintains the mentors.debian.net software is loath to modify it. And then I said, whatever, I'll make some changes. And it turns out I didn't want to either, because it's historic. And there's this old rewrite from 2 years ago, except we're not using it.
Mm.
The prime reason we're not using it, well, I wasn't even sure. So I decided that, and Christoph Haas was the mentor for Johnny Lamb when Johnny Lamb wrote... There's a bunch of noise in the background. I'm a little concerned.
Oh, no, it's all set.
Okay, cool. So Christoph Haas was the mentor for Johnny Lamb when Johnny Lamb wrote it as a Summer of Code project in 2008.
Mm.
And Christoph Haas also wrote mentors.debian.net, so he understood the requirements for the new version. But then it wasn't fully finished by the time Summer of Code ended. And then Johnny went away to work on other projects, and Christoph now has this sort of code dump. It's been worked on throughout the summer, but there's no activity on it as of the end of 08.
Mm.
And sort of like, oh, I have so many other things to do, and I wish this were done. And so every couple of months, he really hopes that we can revive the Deb Expo code. And I said, look, clearly this sucks for you, so let's make it better. So I tried to revive that, and... it turns out the code is actually pretty good for Deb Expo. It makes a really nice web page. You can see it. So about a month and a half ago, no, I guess about a month ago, Christoph was telling me, it makes me so frustrated when people on Debian Devel say, you can't revive Deb Expo, it's dead.
Mm.
And I said, okay, then we'll revive it together because we need to do better for the mentees. And so, I wrote this email inviting people to contribute, and I downloaded the code and took a look, and eventually I started running it on my own machine that I've put online at expo.debian.net. And The code is generally pretty good, and it looks very nice. And at the same time that I was writing this request for help, somebody else wrote an email to the Debian Python list. And this guy, Andre, he says, hey, so I want to contribute to Debian. I've worked on some other Linux distributions in the past. What can I do? And so the Debian Python mailing list says, go read the wiki page for the Debian Python team. And he says, I read the page, but it didn't give anything specific to do. And then the silence in that thread. So a few days later, I go back to him and I say, hey, do you want to help me with Dev Expo? And so I got him on board to that, and we chatted in IRC, and I gave him permission to modify the deployment, and he's been totally fixing bugs, and it's great. And this is, again, what I mean by I just write emails, and I just hope other people help out. So I think I said that we'd get Dev Expo online by November 5th, and that we'd get it online to replace mentors.debian.net by December 5th. Mm. And I think that we can manage that.
That's pretty cool.
And, like, I'm hardly doing anything. I'm just writing emails. What I'm really doing is, in Debian, we often say things like, in a volunteer project, the limiting factor is human time.
Mm.
But I actually think the limiting factor is contributor enthusiasm and contributor confidence.
Well, and I guess coordinating or directing the people in the right direction. Like, you know, that guy was willing to do something on the mailing list. He's like, well, what do I do? And then he didn't hear anything back, and you're like, hey, here's something for you to do.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. So I think there's also sort of that, you know, I don't want to say it's a problem, but it's just, you know, there are some people who are kind of self-motivated and know what they want to do, and they go out and do it. But then there's other people who are motivated, but just don't know where to aim that motivation, and they sometimes need to be pointed in the right direction.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe later in this conversation, we'll talk about how I found the Alpine package, and that's sort of the same story for me, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, Andre is self-motivated. He looked at the bug tracker for Dev Expo, he fixed some bugs, he hung out in the IRC channel, he's still there. It's just a matter of helping people. I guess the way I think about it is that the other thing I do a lot, other than write email, is read email and lurk on IRC. So I'm actually, in Freenode, you can initially, I think, most people can only be on like 25 Freenode channels, but I got them to lift that limit for me. And now I'm at the server limit of 125.
Oh, there you go.
And, you know, other than a massive waste of bandwidth, what I'm doing is just paying attention to how people are communicating. And so what I end up with is a lot of knowledge about what's going on where.
Mm.
And this isn't something that Andre necessarily has. If he had it, he might make the same decisions as I did, that DevExpo was a good product to work on, so I can just inform him of that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I guess since you mentioned Alpine, I'd like to see how you got into that, because Alpine's pretty cool.
Yeah. Sure. So I mentioned that, you know, in the turn of the century, like, you know, 99, 2000, 2001, I really enjoyed reading and writing email in Alpine. And I really, in Pine.
Yeah, it was Pine then, yeah.
And it was really cool having sort of one of the really cool things about running a GNU Linux system on it as a desktop is your desktop feels like a server.
Mm.
You can have multiple user accounts, you can SSH in, you can use it to break through the restrictive firewalls at high school. Like, whatever you need is there for you. And, you know, so you can configure it as a mail server. And then it just like made me feel really like I was on the internet in a very like direct sense to be running a Linux system with a mail server and, you know, like the classic email reader of the 1990s, Pine. It's been sort of the one I've excised more and more non-free software from my life. And I guess I should just mention that we're chatting now on Mumble, which is this free software VoIP package that
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, eventually Windows 98 would crash every 20 minutes, and then that was normal, actually. But then eventually it erased my master boot record, so I couldn't boot into Linux or Windows anymore. And at this point, this is like 2001, I was like, why am I bothering with Windows? So I just didn't reinstall
it. Yeah, there you go.
And, but like, Pine is non-free. Its license has this famous polarity where you have permission to modify or redistribute it. So everyone's like, sweet, I'm going to redistribute modified versions. And then the University of Washington says, no, redistribute or modify. And everyone just sort of turns their head and like their eyes bug out. Like, what? That doesn't mean and or? So two things happened, two major things happened. One is Pine gets moved to non-free and Debian, and well, sure. And the other thing is that Richard Stallman from then on says every license will have and/or if that's what it means.
Yeah.
So, you know, a couple other things happened. Courier tried to make their own Pine-like program called Cone.
Mm.
And, of course, there's GNU Nano, which is like the Pico editor.
Yeah.
And, sure. So, you know, going forward through high school and college, like, Pine is the one blemish on my mostly free software belief system and actions. And so then in, I think, October 2006 or so, I saw somewhere, maybe Slashdot, that the University of Washington was going to finally ship a free software version of Pine called Alpine. And at this point, I had already been contributing a little bit to Debian. I maintained like three packages that were all little sort of minute file conversion tools, just like stuff I discovered that had a request for package filed that I could put together. And sort of, I was like, wow, this is my calling. I can be the one to be there when Pine is replaced by Alpine in free software, as free software in Debian. It can be mine. Like, Pine has been weighing down on me all this time, and so I can pay that back by maintaining Alpine
for
Debian users. And so that was sort of my calling. And so it took me, like, I've been contributing to Debian here and there for like a year until I discovered something that really fit what I wanted. And so it was sort of by maintaining Alpine and by updating it to new versions that I understood enough Debian packaging stuff and had enough mentor and sponsor in Benjamin Mako Hill that I could go through the new maintainer process.
Mm. Okay. You always could have used like Mutt and Fetch Mail, couldn't you, instead of Pine? That's probably a whole nother can of worms. I mean, you don't want to open.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, there's a couple of things wrong with Mutt from my perspective. There's this fact that maybe it's not entirely Mutt's fault, but junior year, first semester, I was like, okay, Pine is non-free. Now, you know, I have some time. I can play with Mutt and see if that'll be better or good enough for me. And so I used Mutt full-time for a semester, and that was by far, like, emotionally, the worst semester of my college experience.
Because of Mutt?
It's hard to say. But, I mean, the thing that, like, Pine is a case study for me in usable software, because the bottom two rows of the screen are dedicated to help text.
Mm.
Wherever you are, it'll tell you what you can do right there. And they actually learned an enormous amount about email by using Pine. And by feeling like it was always a reasonable idea to change configurations or play with new menu options. And, oh yeah, and the other thing is that Mutt's IMAP support is terrible. And
yeah, that's what I've heard.
I'm a deep IMAP partisan because of this one time running Mandrake, probably, like, you know, back in the 20th century. And I was like, oh, cool, Emacs has an email client called Rmail. I'll use Rmail just for a minute, and we'll see what it's like. And then I did. I was like, okay, I don't really like it that much. But I discovered that it had moved all my email into its own mail format called Rmail.
Oh, no.
And now I had to search the web for a script called unRmail, which I didn't even know existed yet. And at this point, I decided, like, you know, like Captain Picard and in first contact. The line must be drawn here. Like, my email client will not be permitted to directly interact with my email. It can only interact with it over some protocol where nothing stupid can happen.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, unintentionally. And that protocol was IMAP. And so from then on. And it's been really nice because I can run Alpine on my laptop. I can run Alpine as stations my server. I can use Thunderbird to access the same mail spool.
Right, right. Yeah, and you have the same email across no matter what you're using.
Yeah. I mean, IMAP does have its problems, but here I am, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I guess kind of speaking of your school experiences and whatnot, I know you mentioned before that you're involved with like Creative Commons and Students for Free Culture. Can we touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, totally. So I guess in 2002, I started going to college, and I was already a free software partisan by then, because I'd already read the GNU Manifesto, and I did some more reading. The other thing that happened in high school was the John Johansson's DCSS program was the first test case for the anti-circumvention clause in the American Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Mm. And this was just eye-opening for me. Because on one hand, there's Richard Stallman sort of snapshotted in the 80s in this document, the GNU Manifesto, talking about the importance of a community of hackers in the good sense, in the community sense, being, sharing software and building stuff together. And then on the other hand, I read in the news of the very day, sitting in my chair, the Motion Picture Association wants to put in jail a Norwegian teenager for writing his own DVD player.
Mm.
And, like, there's such a clash here.
Yeah.
And so I'm actually kind of lucky to have sort of been coming of age, technology-wise, at a time where there was such a fight going on as DCSS.
Mm.
And so I got to college in 2002, like totally switched on to software freedom. And then I see Lawrence Lessig has started this other organization called Creative Commons the same year. And it translates these ideals of software freedom to non-programming by espousing ideals of sharing and creating the legal necessities of licenses for that. And, he writes that he's inspired by the free software movement. And I sort of immediately felt like, in the back of my mind, I will always be working for free software. But maybe what I will do will start by being about explaining the ideas of it through things people who aren't programmers can understand directly. And that's the ability to modify cultural content, the ability to do remix, the permission to have artists make music that you're allowed to share.
Yeah.
And so I was sort of like, really, I felt a kinship with CC. So then in 2003, I sort of retained this feeling and getting more and more into Debian. And also, there was this big lawsuit between a voting machine manufacturer named Diebold and some students and an ISP who were trying to share memos by Diebold voting systems. Where the memos had all sorts of malfeasance, evidence of malfeasance by Diebold and Diebold election systems. I said, this is a great little test case. Anyway, I ended up writing some testimony for the Electronic Frontier Foundation because I got involved in a sort of indirect way. Mm. But through this, I met Nelson Pavlovsky and Luke Smith, who were students at Swarthmore College. And they had an organization there called the Swarthmore Coalition for the Digital Commons. And as far as I could tell, this was the EFF Creative Commons fan club.
Okay.
And with free software mixed in there, too.
Right.
And they did things. I visited Swarthmore October of 2003, and I met Luke Smith, and he showed me that they had just written in sidewalk chalk the prime number that encodes the DCSS program in front of the student center. And I was like, okay, these guys are awesome. So then these guys were the head of that memo distribution legal issue through EFF. I mean, they were the student side.
Yeah.
And they discovered over the year 2003 to 2004 that, like me, there were a bunch of other students at other colleges who were really excited about technology freedom and wanted to get involved and would even go so far as to expose themselves to possible legal risk by uploading these memos. Mm. So they took this Fourth World Coalition for the Digital Commons and they turned it into a broader international movement of chapters at different colleges called FreeCulture.org, now called Students for Free Culture. And so I was always around then and mostly did tech work to make the organization work better or offer web hosting to chapters. And eventually I interned at Creative Commons in summer 2006 while I was still a student. And then I worked there for 2 years from mid 07 to mid 09.
That's cool.
It was really cool. Like, I remember being in the CC office with an intern. Like, I'm still kind of, at this point, confused that these luminaries are willing to have me in their office. And Mia Garlick, who was then the chief counsel, was on a phone call with Evan Moglen talking about possible compatibility with the GNU Free Documentation License. And I'm sitting there listening to the conference call.
Man.
I know. So, you know, and yeah, so, you know, then like that was a pretty exciting place to be. And I've stayed involved with Students for Free Culture. They've got dozens of chapters at dozens of colleges and universities across the world. And I stayed with Creative Commons for 2 years.
Can you mention or talk about a little bit what the Students for Free Culture, like what they do, like if you sign up or, you know, if you try to create a chapter at your school or whatever, like how does that work and what does that involve?
Yeah, totally. So Students for Free Culture chapters are really typically defined by the people who lead them. Like you get a lot of flexibility. So to give you some taste of the kinds of events people have done, at MIT, Mako went around to the library and labeled journals with how much they cost to try to give people who browse the MIT libraries a sense of the huge amounts of money the library is paying in fees to journal providers. And the thing about paying for academic journals when you are an academic institution is that, so here's the process. Step one, academics write a paper. Step two, other academics, without being paid for it, do peer review.
Mm.
Step three, academics hand over the copyright to companies like Elsevier, who then, step four, charge the library for permission to distribute those academics' papers. Mm. And, you know, you kind of wonder, like, what is the value that Elsevier is providing that is worth $60,000 a year for the nuclear physics in one case? And so there's this open access movement that has been growing in force in academia where there are some costs, for sure, in making these journal articles. But what you want is to have everybody be able to read them. And this is important not just in, you know, as usual, it's not important just in a free as in cost issue. Like, okay, it's a shame that MIT pays $60,000 a year for this journal, but like, big deal, right? The important thing, MIT has billions of dollars, probably. The important thing is the fact that nearly nobody else on the planet can read these journals. This is science. This is the progress of humanity's knowledge. And because Elsevier has placed itself structurally to exploit academics who don't want to fight copyright licensing issues,
right,
they've locked humanity out of progress of reading these journal articles.
Mm.
So this is the real issue. And that's why this is an example of where free culture and free software have something in common, in that the free culture movement recognizes that access to knowledge, you know, participation basis of culture. That's really what the free software movement is also about.
Yeah.
And so Mako labels these journals with how much they cost and writes this up and explains to people. Fred Benenson at NYU and a bunch of other students at Columbia, they run this event called Wikis Take Manhattan, where they find things on Wikipedia that don't have photographs taken of them inside New York City, and they go on a photo scavenger hunt. So they're filling in the gap.
Man.
And the different personalities that take things a different way. Another thing that some students do is just focus on making their own university sort of more free culture compliant. So in terms of sharing the information and the knowledge that they're generating, a lot of students are really excited about OpenCourseWare.
Mm.
This had started out as an MIT project for getting course materials online at MIT, and it's grown in 8 years later into this massive multi-continent, multi-university effort.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of room for students within universities to explain to the university how they could do it and to support them. So, but then again, this kind of boils down to Andre's email to the Debian Python list. Like, okay, I want to help. What can I do? So if you don't know what to do, you can join the FC Discuss, the discussion list for Students for Free Culture, and say, hey, I want to start a chapter, and people on the board and the rest of the team will welcome you and give you some ideas.
What kind of support would a person get if they wanted to start their own chapter? Like, what do they help them with?
So, I mean, one of the big things is ideas as to events, what events to do. I mean, there was a UC Santa Cruz chapter that actually ran an in-person file sharing event where you just traded USB keys.
Yeah.
So learning about what other chapters have done is a huge help. Another thing, though, is that the organization provides web hosting for chapters in case the university has a long process for getting web space or they don't install WordPress, whatever.
Yeah.
So, and that's something that I work on a fair bit. And Parker Finney and Tony Biondo and a couple of other people on the web team also do.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I've heard of the Students for Free Culture, but I've never really checked into it I had an idea with sort of something along the lines of what you're saying, but I never, like I said, actually went to the website and checked it out. So I'm definitely going to have to check that out and see what it's all about. Definitely interested in that.
And one more thing I guess is worth saying here is that there are a bunch of so-called one-person chapters at universities. And actually those have definitely had big impacts on those universities and on the organization as a whole. So if your interest isn't so much in outreach as it is in impact, if that makes sense, it totally makes sense to have a chapter and get some stuff done.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that my interest has definitely peaked. So, No, and another thing I want to touch on when we were talking earlier is you mentioned how you moved to Massachusetts due to the open source movement, or I don't think you said movement, but the open source kind of scene into a particular part of Massachusetts. Yeah. And I found that interesting because I myself live in Massachusetts, and I didn't quite know of what you're talking about. So as we talk about Students for Free Culture, and we talked about Libre Planet, which is a sort of a conference that the FSF puts on. And you mentioned you went to that the last 2 years. I'm assuming you're an FSF member.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to talk a little bit about that, and maybe we can touch on the FSF a little bit.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess there's a couple things here. One is why I live in Somerville now, and so I used to live in San Francisco when I worked at Creative Commons. And I sort of wrote about this recently, but within like 2 weeks of being there, I felt almost oppressed by the startup heavy, Mac heavy, like pseudo self-empowerment of startups and web APIs. Mm. Like, you know, I'm sort of jamming a whole lot of words.
A lot of buzzwords.
Right. They all mean something to me. But, so there was, in San Francisco, yeah, I'm slowly getting to answering your question.
Yeah, definitely.
in San Francisco, in the first 2 weeks, I went to an event called Super Happy Dev House, which is a big programmer party a little bit south of the city of San Francisco, you know, probably 50 to 120 people with laptops and there for a whole daytime in the weekend. Mm. And probably like a third of the people were wide-eyed, really enthusiastic about making Facebook apps because the Facebook API had just come out or just changed or something. And like internally, I was revolted.
Yeah.
Like, is this really all we have computers for to help make Facebook lock in users better? I hope not. So there was one pretty cool dude in the corner who was, you know, friendly, communicative, happy, working on this Perl-based SITP daemon. And that was interesting. It was free software. But I felt like in this whole event, I felt defensive about the value of free software. I felt like the people who really enjoyed building on top of other proprietary APIs, who enjoyed the big access to people they had through using the Facebook API, like, I felt like, you know, I almost afraid that I have nothing concrete like that to offer if I say it's important that users be able to modify the software they have and that society not get locked into proprietary interests, corporate interests. They'd be like, yeah, but look at the impact you can have if you set up a Facebook API thing. And it would just like, if it's depressing. Like, there's actually, there's a blog post for me early on in my work at Creative Commons where I made a patch to Apache and blogged about it on the Creative Commons tech blog. And it's interesting reading that now because I can read in my words the frustration I felt, like, being defensive about the importance of free software.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, totally.
And this is no way to have me feel, like, supported enough to be critical and then help analyze and improve the community. So I lived in Philadelphia for a year between, I said, September 09 and September 2010. And I really enjoyed things there. But in all this time that I was in college, in San Francisco, in Philadelphia, I would always end up visiting Boston and really Cambridge and hang out with people sort of clustered around MIT who care about free software. And this all sort of came together for me when summer of 07, I went to a Students for Free Culture conference and met Mako and, I guess felt connected to that scene. So there's just a bunch of Debian people there who, yeah, but I mean, I think that's the sort of the moral of the story. Like, you asked me, what's this free software community in the Massachusetts state that attracted me to the Boston area? And it's the fact that there's a really big bunch of Debian developers living around there who care about free software and who are active, so I can keep hearing about new projects and feeling like I'm connected.
Nice. So you mentioned you went to Libre Planet. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that's all about?
Yeah, so I went to Libre Planet. I think it's happened twice, if I recall correctly. One in 09, once in 2010. Yeah. And in 2009, it was this big unconference with like a whirl of activity. So I guess I don't know what to. I guess the important take home from Libre Planet 09 for me was maybe the biggest thing that happened was that I got an award. I and Mike Linksphere went up to the stage to receive an award by Richard Solomon.
Oh, really?
I was being congratulated for. So the award wasn't to me. The award was for Creative Commons.
Okay.
As a project of that upheld the ideals of free software in a different way. And you know, in a way, this is how thrilling to have Richard Stallman recognize this and have me be around with Mike Linksphere, VP Creative Commons, to receive this. Because this is something, like I said, that 8 years ago I really identified
with. Yeah.
And that I really still do. And it's also really interesting in that just as I joined Creative Commons, Larry Lessig was winding down his involvement in the CC organization. Mm. And at least his direct involvement. And so he was doing things like seeing how he can repair the organization's relationship with the Free Software Foundation. Because there were these licenses that Creative Commons used to recommend that didn't permit. So Richard Stallman has this standard that it's unethical for for anybody to restrict non-commercial verbatim copying of any creative
work. Right.
And there were some Creative Commons licenses that did restrict even that basic degree of freedom. The two big ones were the digging up skeletons here, but the two big ones were the sampling license, which permitted only small partial reuse as samples, and the so-called developing nations license, which permits countries that are in the least developed status according to UN development agency, permits all use of a work inside those countries and no use outside of
them. Okay.
And these were sort of license experiments that Larry started, and I think that part of why these were retired in the middle of 2007, right as I was starting at CC, was that Larry wanted to repair his relationship with the Free Software Foundation as he was leaving, so that as the organization moved forward, it wouldn't have that baggage. And so it was really interesting to see. It's almost like and part of why this was important to repair that relationship was that Creative Commons and Wikipedia both wanted to move Wikipedia into a Creative Commons license rather than the GNU free documentation license that they've been using all along. And for that to happen, the only realistic way is for the GFDL, is for the authors of the GFDL, the Free Software Foundation, to permit that kind of relicensing. So if you think just in a practical terms, that's one benefit to repairing this, improving this relationship.
Right.
And so that all happened, and it's just like the history of my being at CC, I have nothing to do with this, but I just watched as the giants, Larry and Richard, are identifying their grievances and resolving them, and it ends in this. The first time I go to Boston for Libre Planet, nothing to do with me, I get to walk on the stage and help receive this award for CC.
That's pretty cool.
It reminds me of like when I was in that conference room with Evan Moglen on the phone and Mia Garlick.
So then was the 2010 conference a little more organized then?
Yeah, so I mean, the unconference in 2009 was actually really interesting. But the 2010 conference had a lot of really great things about it, actually. So they selected a bunch of really, really good speakers to speak on the first day, on the Saturday. And I just left it really impressed. And they had a great conversation, a drinking and snacks evening, where we got to better know the attendees. And, well, we attendees got to better know each other. That is,
yeah.
And then on Sunday, I spent most of the day in Women in Free Software Focus Day. And that was particularly interesting. I haven't touched on it much in this talk, and that's a tragedy, especially since we're like already past an hour in. But I think that the diversity problems in the free software movement are really important to identify and address. It's just like we were talking before about students who never really learn about the importance of free software.
Yeah.
Even if they're using it. So many people never learn about free software at all. Or if they do, like the students who never learn about the importance, a lot of people use it and never really understand emotionally, truly, psychologically, that they can participate and submit a patch.
Yeah.
Or that they can write documentation, or that they can help out an IRC. Or in my case, the first thing I did for a project that wasn't mine, I started a wiki that ended up getting really widely used. Like, there's so much you can do. And, in this Women's Caucus Day on Sunday, we had some talks about how, Hannah Wallach and Chris Ball particularly talked about when GNOME did Summer of Code for the first time, they got zero applicants who were women. And they were blown away by this emptiness. So Hannah Wallach said, okay, we could do better. Let's raise some money and do a women's only Summer of Code at the same time, not funded by Google, but funded by some other people. And this time we'll handle outreach better. This time we'll ask our friends, hey, do you know any women who like free software? Do they want to work on it over the summer? Tell them to get in touch with us. And they had no shortage of applicants. And it's because they just did outreach.
That's interesting.
The So that was, yeah, that was a really, like, a really great example that Hannah gave at this event. And one other fun thing that happened on Sunday was there was this troll in the room who sort of half seriously was being sexist and, like, shouting down people and sort of standing up for the people who believe in bias and whatever, wrong things. And so eventually there started to be the shouting match between him and this other, actually, man in the back of the room who was like, shut up, we're trying to learn about women in free software and you're just yelling people down and trolling. And I managed to help resolve the situation, which was really relieving. By at this point, the guy in the back, the troll in the front is getting yelled at by the guy in the back. The guy in the back asks him to just get out of the room. The guy in the front says, how can you kick me out of this room? This room is about inclusiveness. And I said, look, it's okay if you stay in the room as long as you don't say anything. And he was like, okay.
That was easy.
That was this. Yeah. But that was Libra Planet. And the t-shirts were really nice. They were on, like, really nice, smooth, I think, organic cotton, and probably, I don't have one on me, but I think they're American Apparel. And most importantly, though, they had on the front of this logo a whole bunch of an amalgam of logos from different free software projects, and the motto, working together for free software. Which, as a conference, is exactly the right message. And I think for the free software movement, exactly the right message.
Yeah. So speaking of the right messages, we were kind of talking about the Free Software Foundation, how maybe some of their not right messages would you want to touch on that a little bit, or?
Sure. Yeah. So, so there was this in, I guess I've sort of had this background of frustration with a bunch of the Free Software Foundation's messaging. Because, like, I'm a convert. I believe deeply that users shouldn't be restricted in what they can do with the software they have. And I believe that this is a really important issue for society to address, or else we're going to end up more and more locked into not making choices about our own future, truly as a society.
Yeah.
And, you know, the example I always think about with this is Skype. Like, Skype is this nice, remarkable, easy to use, easy to sign up for and pay them, and that's a great thing. VoIP program that in China, if you download it, has this one feature you might not like, which is that it randomly, pseudo-randomly, sends information about your calls to a database server in China.
That's...
You know, it just has this one misfeature. And it might be nice if you could remove this, but Skype is radically rigged to be resilient to debuggers. It actually modifies the program at runtime, and if it runs timing tests, and there's certain timing tests that it runs because it thinks they'll be slower inside a debugger. And if they're slower, then it corrupts the self-recompiling program, so it ends up with basically a crash you can't reproduce outside the debugger.
Man.
It's phenomenal. It's really impressive work. And the actual accidental result is that it empowers Chinese surveillance agents to spy on Chinese guys.
Right, I mean, not only China, who knows who else?
Right, of course. I mean, yeah, so let me emphasize that, like, I'm an FSF member. The Free Software Foundation has done awesome work, and free software is a really important movement that deserves the hardlineness that the FSF gives it. But the thing that frustrates me sometimes is that the messaging doesn't help people understand. So I read this, I got this press release email beginning of October that was called Windows Phone 7, the best choice for patent trolls. And one thing I try to do in my life is to step back and say, if I weren't me, what would it be like to see what I see? And, like, you know, the best choice for patent trolls, if you don't know about how terrible software patents are yet, because you only just signed up for the FSF's email list, or you don't know what a patent troll is because you don't follow patent litigation,
right,
then this doesn't mean very much to you. So it's failed to perform. And it just like tied into this backdrop of frustration for me. So I finally like got over myself and actually emailed them back and said, hey, here are some particular parts that aren't good. So I did read them aloud to you and quote them in part, and you can find the original on ashish.org, my letter, and the original FSF press release on the FSF press releases. Windows Phone 7 series is another cookie cutter example of Microsoft's bumbling maliciousness to everything it does, said Matt Lee, FSF campaigns manager. And this is just disappointing to me, because there, every once in a while, Microsoft does something good. We forget, because it's drowned out by, you know, 99.999% probably of radically freedom violating nonsense. But when you tell, you know, as an organization like the FSF that wants particular actions from Microsoft, to say that this is a cookie cutter example of Microsoft's bumbling maliciousness to everything it does, it doesn't. If I worked at Microsoft, if I were part of their open source lab there, which they have one, I would say this makes working with the FSF not fun. I'm not interested in calling up Matt Lee and saying, hi, I would like to improve the situation. What's one concrete thing that Microsoft can do to make it ourselves less horrifying to the physical community? I don't know. With the press release also failed to include any information about why Windows 7 was bad. It just recited the backdrop of Microsoft's bad actions. And so as a press release, it didn't really inform. Maybe the purpose was to rile up enthusiasm from people who already believe the Free Software Foundation message. But I guess, like, I already believe that. I want to learn something.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I think sometimes, like, I don't know if they're that way on purpose, like to try to draw more attention, maybe, or if it is the thinking really that like that radical. I'm also a member, and you know, like you, I also agree with, you know, the free software stance. And like I said before, you know, if it weren't for Richard Stallman and him drawing that hard line in the sand, we wouldn't be you know, anywhere near where we are now. But, you know, at the same time, like you said, writing it out like that isn't very informative, and it's a very, you either hate it or you love it, what they say. And there's nothing in between there for to inform people on, you know, like you said, why this is a bad thing. And, you know.
Yeah. So I can provide a couple of different ways to do this email. And then with that in mind, I want to propose a really concrete suggestion. So with this press release, I guess I would have liked to have heard specifics about what makes Windows Mobile 7 bad. I mean, the beginning, just the press release really just talks about Microsoft's backdrop of, as I said, bad actions, which is reasonable enough. But there are other groups that are promoting social movements. And it's important to look at them and see what they do. And if we want Microsoft to act differently, which would be pretty cool, then it would behoove us, I think, to congratulate them every once in a while when they do something that's actually good. And I guess I don't see this from the Free Software Foundation, and I find that really disheartening. So, and I think that to congratulate them on a particular activity, you know, in the first paragraph, and then spend the next six paragraphs ranting about the specific other horrifying nonsense actions they're taking, that would be great. I would love that. It's like, you know, for example, services for Unix, their old Unix interoperability toolkit they bought from some companies, GPLware. They run a free software hosting site called CodePlex that hosts a bunch of admittedly mostly Microsoft.NET only projects, but they're actually free software. And they abandoned their old I think that they abandoned their old shared source licenses for ones that are actually free software. I'd have to look up the history. But so there are nice things to say. I just sprinkle them in every once in a while. It makes me want to
read. Yeah.
So here's what I think we should do as a community. So before I get to that, the other awesome thing about living in Boston and living in Somerville is the FSF is like 4 miles away from the T. Like easy. And people from the FSF often come to this Sunday night bar meetup at a place called Grendel's in Cambridge. And so like I get to chat with them about this. Which is like phenomenal. So I get to find out from people like Don and Matt Lee and old FSF employees like Deb, like what they think and the reasoning inside the FSF. And it seems like, from what I understand, the reasoning for press releases like this is that the FSF, like many nonprofits, like many charities that deserve a lot of help and effort and attention, they're underfunded. And they feel, so a lot of what they do is sort of internally oriented around how can we take the people who already support us and help them support us more and convince them to give us more so we can run our operations better? And this is, this is huge. Like, the FSF recently lost a bunch of staff, and I wish that they had more money to be able to keep doing the things those staff people were doing. And so, so with that in mind, here's what I would like to see. And, I kind of think we've talked for like an hour and a half now, but I kind of think that if you slice out everything except what I'm about to say right now, that would be just fine. So here's what I think. I think that, we, the Free Software fans who believe deeply in the Free Software Foundation's mission, but think that there's some tactics sometimes aren't optimal, we can ask the FSF to just do some marketing science. So, There's things you can do to measure how often people click through from a press release into the web page that describes the press release in more detail. Or you can, and this doesn't have to be personal, it doesn't have to be trackable, it can just be an aggregate. So you can send out two press releases, one that's the style of this one, and one that's sort of nicer. And I would totally volunteer to write the nicer, friendlier one, and I would totally volunteer to having it checked over by the FSF to make sure that it holds up to the high rigor and urgency of the FSF of this mission. I'm not suggesting they are wishy-washy on free software.
Right.
Quite the opposite. I'm suggesting that they still hammer this point. I think that we should get the FSF to run these A/B tests where they send out a nice version and the current angry version and figure out some good things to measure. Like maybe how many people click out of the email into the press release, or how many people go from the email to donate to the FSF. And find out from the readership, from the reader FSF's press release list, what works. And I think that the FSF needs help financially to do this because they're so understaffed right now. And I think so. I think that we should raise $10,000 as a community to convince the FSF that we care about the quality of messaging, and we want them to spend the time to experiment with this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I would find a way to contribute somehow.
That's awesome. Great.
So on that note, then, everyone needs to go to FSF.org and either become a member if you're not one. If you're a student, you can afford $5 a month. You spend more than that on coffee every day, so,
Yeah, and that's how I started, and that's, now I'm a grown-up.
Right.
I'm a grown-up.
And which, again, is only at the lowest you can come in at is even $10 a month. So, it's not much to ask. You can make a one-time donation. You just need to go to the FSF.org. If it wasn't for that, GNU Linux wouldn't exist, probably. So.
Yeah. And it completely, I was talking with Joshua Gay about, he was one of the co-editors of the Stallman's book, Free Software, Free Society, in 2002. And he was highlighting to me that the Linux kernel in 1991 was not all that useful without a C library that let people write applications targeted to it. And so the GNU libc maintainers put in huge amounts of effort, probably a huge fraction of what it took to write the kernel itself, to make libc work against the kernel. And this is like, the FSF GNU are the cornerstone of the free software movement. And by all means, we should become members. And also, though, we should challenge them to live up to the expectations.
Yeah, definitely. And if you think they're a little too radical and a little too edgy for you, I'd highly recommend downloading some of Richard Stallman. He has a couple of videos, but he has a ton of audio speeches that you can download. Definitely listen to some of them. He does some on GNU/Linux, and he also does some on free software. And if you listen to this man speak, he is really, really intelligent. I think he's a very good speaker, and he gets his point across. And if you hear him talk, you will then understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people have never heard him talk, and they just kind of go on what other people probably say about him, or you know, they might just see like pictures of him or whatever. But if you listen to him talk, you might at least reconsider, you know, what you think about the FSF or whatever. At least you would reconsider it. You know, you still might not change your mind, but at least then you'd have a good place to stand to actually cast your judgment or whatever. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ashish, I thank you so much for your time and all of your emails that you send out and your efforts in Debian. And we'll definitely have to get together. We're in the same neck of the woods, so we'll definitely have to catch up with each other and see what we can do. And I would love to contribute in any way that I could. So
cool. Yeah. Well, then maybe I think as far as getting the FSF to reconsider. I mean, so I'm really excited about getting the FSF to pay more attention to the impact of these marketing strategies, and. So I guess I'll talk with them. I think the big hurdle, I think, will be getting them to be willing to. The last thing I want to do is to be sort of, you know, waving $10,000 in front of them with a
condition. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really want to get there.
Yeah,
there
definitely.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for having me. It's been a lot of fun. It's been an hour and a half. And so anyone who sat through this, if you find me on
Facebook, there you go. Well, on Sunday nights, what's the bar that'll have to show up?
Yeah, Grendel's.
There you go. It's right by Logan Square. On a Sunday, you're gonna have to just walk in the bar and yell out Ashish. If you see someone turn around, that's him. Walk up to him and say, "You owe me a beer, dude. I listened to This Week in Debian episode 11. You totally owe me a beer."
That's right. Yeah.
No problem, Dan. Like I said, I'll email you and we'll talk some more. Awesome. Thanks, man, for your time, and have a good day. All right.
You too.
Thank you for listening to This Week in Debian. If you know someone or you yourself are in the Debian community, please get a hold of us so we can interview you. If you'd like to get a hold of us, our email address is feedback@frostbitemedia.org. Again, that email address is feedback@frostbitemedia.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.